As we're beginning our sitting, give attention to the breath, and really try to anchor attention in the body, in the experience of the breath. It's quite common for us to sort of drift into the concept of the breath, the idea of the breath, the thought of meditation, and miss the actual experience, to really ground attention in the actual experience of the breath, and really be attentive to the sensation of the breath as it comes in, and being very present for the breath. As you breathe in at the tip of your nose, to attend to that sensation in a way that is really trying to feel it rather than just watch it, and to let the body receive the breath. As the breath goes out, then to just let the body relax and let the breath follow its nature. It's going to go out of the body. But to be very present for that, to be very attentive, almost like riding the breath, or just being really with the breath. And I've never ever surfed, but it's sort of the image coming up of like that. In order to surf, one really has to be with the wave and with the water. And you can't just be sort of on your board and thinking about something else or thinking about what you're doing. You have to be really present. So that, in a similar way, just being with the... that's how I imagine it would be with, say, surfing. But... certainly with the breath, that is what we have to do. We have to be with the breath. So that comes to mind is that just how Ajahn Lee uses that phrase, keeping the breath in mind. So it's like really keeping the breath in the mind. It's not letting the breath wander, and not letting the mind wander. Keeping the breath in mind, keeping the mind on the breath, and say both those have to be working together, and lovely image that he gives of just in the same way for eating, you have to when you eat, you have to sort of get the spoon into the mouth, and you have to get the mouth onto the spoon. It's just, they both have to sort of work together, and if we ate in the same way that we watched our breath, and when we're meditating, the spoon would not reach the mouth. The mouth would be missing the spoon a lot. There would be a big mess around one if one were say, eating in the same way that we meditate. So to and really bringing that attention to the sensation of the breath, the mind being with the breath being on the mind, in the mind. I said that the mind, the awareness envelops and surrounds the breath. It's there, it's present for it, it's with it, it's experiencing it fully. And to really bring that onto the experiential level, and to be relaxing the body, not making it into the meditation into something that is really driven or tense or tight, because that takes the mind away from the breath as well. If you're forcing too hard, or you're just to have this driven feeling behind it, and the whole point of the meditation is to be experiencing a quality of tranquility and ease. So to bring that into each breath as you begin the breathing process, you begin the meditation, the beginning of each breath, of each in-breath, the beginning of each out-breath, to be really relaxing and settling, bringing a sense of ease into the meditation, into the body. Again, that's really grounding awareness in the body. The mindfulness of breathing is a bodily experience. And just to really engage the body in that process, and be very allow awareness to suffuse the body, so that there's kind of a full awareness that is receiving the breath and is present with the breath. It's like the story I've told many times of the person who I met, and it's the first year I was meditating and living at another meditation center, not Ajahn Chah's. This person had been practicing in a Zen monastery, Rinzai Zen Monastery in Japan, and he'd gone and lived there for quite some time. And the Rinzai style is to the koan style, where you go eat, you know, in periods of sesshin, you would be going and periods of meditation, retreat periods, you'd be going giving an answer to your koan each day, and sometimes a couple times a day even, where you're supposed to come and present the answer, the response to the koan, and then the teacher will sort of evaluate the response, and then either let you know whether it's off or on, and then send you back to continue meditating if you didn't get the answer to the koan properly. And of course, what happens is there's this, people just keep this endless line of people going into to see the roshi. Present you do your bows, you give your answer, and then the roshi rings a bell, and then that's your dismissal. Go back and meditate. That's just this this particular person was getting extremely frustrated, because he'd go in, come up with an answer to his koan. He'd get the bell rung, have to do his bows, go back and meditate, and I'm not getting this. This is really frustrating. And then he'd, after some time, each time he would get dismissed, the roshi would, and the roshi was was very big, and he was a big man, as well as having a big sort of belly on him, a big gut. And he'd ring the bell, dismiss him, and he'd slap his belly and laugh and say, "Body understands." And it was getting this endless frustration of he's working away and trying to figure out his meditation and trying to figure out this koan and meditating with his mind, and the Roshi keeps telling him, "Body understands." And he spent his whole time there and never did figure it out there. But that sense of experience, being fully experiencing something, so that the mind is on the breath is in the mind, the body is present with full awareness. Awareness is enveloping and surrounding the body completely, so that there's not a separation. And the breath is what one is attending to. One is experiencing fully, knowing clearly the breath. And it's the body is the base, the anchor. And to allow the awareness and attention to absorb into the sensation of the breath, to allow the breath to receive the awareness and attention, for the body, the bodily sensation of the breath, to be, say, permeable, to be ready to receive that awareness. So that sense of real integration of the body mind, and that being with the breath is very, very important. It's a sensation. It's a bodily sensation, and then just grounding attention in the body. And in order to do that, one has to sort of really relax the whole body. It's not, the breath is not separate from the rest of the body. There's not this breath happening, and then there's a body that one can just sort of just put up with or set aside. The whole body is what is breathing. The whole body is what is present for the breath. And is where the mind, of course, is grounded, is anchored, and that you notice in Buddhist practice that in the Paticchasamuppada that we chanted this morning, that nama rupa it's always working together, the body mind. Is always there. Form and the mental processes are together. They're not. It's not a separate thing. And even in the Paticchasamuppada, the vijnana paccaya nama rupam is with consciousness as condition. There is the body mind experiences. On it's. Say the traditional explanation is always the relinking consciousness, rebirth consciousness. Then there is body and mind. It's always it's not as if we've got disembodied consciousness that is functioning in the world in order for. A human life to exist, there needs to be body and mind, and that is what sustains life through the whole sort of our whole existence. So that if for some reason the body is jeopardized or dies, and then that is Well, that is it. What am I? Consciousness, the mind ceases to have a formal relationship with the body. The body dies, and these are integral functions. And so that in meditation, really trying to recognize that, to honor that, and to become, and particularly for us, I think it's important to really attend to the body, the bodily experience, so that we're really having a stable anchor for in the meditation. And I've been talking about the hindrances these last days, and it's as meditators, then we have to be savvy to what is a hindrance, how do they show themselves, what do they manifest as, and how do they obstruct us, obstruct awareness and weaken wisdom. How do they keep doing that? And what's it like when there isn't hindrances? The images that the Buddha uses which illustrates both of those aspects is the aspect of water, so that the mind, without hindrances, is like clear, clear still water, very clear, very clean, very pure, and there are discourses where the Buddha talks of when the mind settles and gains basis in stillness and has some insight, then the mind is able to see things clearly, just as if one were standing at the edge of a pool and one could see, those are rocks, those are fish, those are crabs, and you can see through things so clearly, so that the mind that is free from hindrances and free of obstructions is that has this clarity to it. And the mind that with the hindrances, the Buddha gives various images of with sensual desire, then the mind is like water that has various colors put into it, various dyes. And you put red dye in, and it turns red, and you turn blue dye in, it turns blue. Put a few different colors in, and it becomes all a mushy sort of indistinct sort of color. And that, similar with the desire mind, the mind goes out to an object of desire, then it takes on the characteristic of that object, and it's the mind is tainted by the desire for that object, and that's how it starts to view the world, is through that object of desire. That's what one wants, and then that desire is casting a color, coloring everything. Like a pickpocket doesn't actually see people; he just sort of sees pockets and wallets, in the same way that all of our various desires, we start to we shape the world by the various desires that we have, and it starts to color it in that way. that the that hindrance of sensual desire is staining, colouring what was clear, working with that relinquishing of sensual desire gives one the opportunity to come back to a space of clarity and being able to see things more clearly. The hindrance of ill will and aversion, the Buddha compares it to boiling water, and that in that with boiling water, of course, one can't see things clearly in it, the nature of the water changes from something from being sort of clear and sort of still, it becomes very agitated and also just like just ordinary clear cool water, and you can put your finger in it and it's cool, it's refreshing, you could wash your face with it, it's cool and refreshing. With boiling water, I mean, it just, you get burnt, it, you get scalded by it. In the same way, it's just the ill will, aversion, is this scalding tendency, this burning up the mind itself and the objects that it touches. And so when we're, especially in terms of meditation, you know, where we create this real sense of pain in our own hearts when we cling to ill will and aversion, when we buy into the hindrance of ill will, because it really it burns, it scalds. And besides the lack of clarity, it's very painful. And so that too, that working with the hindrances, so that they're, one's able to bring the water back to a place of coolness, allowing it to cool, allowing it to settle down. The hindrance of sloth and torpor is, the Buddha compares it to water that is like in a swamp or a pond, and it has the and has these water plants and scum and on the top that floats on the top and clouds the water. When the water is covered in water hyacinths or these kinds of pond algae that float on the top and covers it up so that one can't see it. And that and the image the Buddha gives, you know, like in order to drink that water, one would need to push that algae, those plants away, so that one could get at the clear pond that's underneath. And in the same way that with sloth and torpor, we need to be able to push those hindrances away. We need to be able to clear them out, put forth the effort to push them back, and that bringing up of energy, bringing up of effort, and clearing the mind off, pushing off the sort of the scum that sits on top of it, or that sort of comes in the same way that with the, you know, with the water sort of, oftentimes you'll see on a pond, depending which way the wind blows, you'll see it moving back and forth, as things, the water plants and different ponds gone. And at that, and then sometimes you can see that sort of cloud of dullness starting to come into the mind when you're meditating, and it's, you need to push that back from immediately rather than letting it sort of drift over one and cloud the mind, cover up the mind that is clear. And that working with that hindrance of sloth and torpor, bringing up the different techniques that are helpful for dispelling that, and certainly that mindfulness of the body, sitting up straight, putting energy in the body. Those are very immediate methods that give one the opportunity to let that hindrance sort of go, at least go back to the edges of the pond and there. The hindrance of restlessness, the Buddha compares to say a pond or a lake with waves on it, so that the surface is unsettled, so it's unsuitable for using as a, one can't see through it very clearly, and one can't use it to as for a reflection, because in, especially in the Buddha's time, one of the ways that were used for mirrors or being able to see things in that surface, like as a mirror that reflected one's image back, was water that was in a dish that was still, and then you would reflect images back. So but water that is, wind is blowing on it, there's waves on it, and you can't see any image, any reflection in that way. And similar, than a reflection on a pond or a stream, if there's a lot of wind blowing, there's ripple and waving on the surface, then one can't see into it either, and that seeing, as in that image of the Buddha gives of seeing the rock, seeing the shoal, seeing the gravel, seeing the fish, seeing the crabs, and it needs to be still in order to, besides being clear, it needs to be still. So restlessness is similar, because sometimes it may not, the mind may not be, going so much even into really negative, aversive, unwholesome things, but it's just kind of restless. Restlessly thinking about good things or benign things, but it's still restless. So it's still not still. It's maybe not, it's not sullied swamped with negativity, but it's not still. It's just restlessness there that is not allowing the mind to see itself clearly. Working with the ways that are skillful in settling that restlessness, bringing up those images that are peaceful, that are settling, and bringing up that just being with the breath in a very complete, present way, is very settling, it's very stilling, very calming. Or bringing up different images in the mind that are bring up a sense of peace, of settling. You're using as an image of object of attention, like an image of the, very peaceful Buddha image. It's a very positive, and there's a very sense of happiness of the sort of the peace of the Buddha. Those are really tends to cut through that restlessness of the mind. So that one uses objects of attention that are settling. The hindrance of doubt is the Buddha gives the that say the image of water that is has muddy or has sediment in it, so it's dirty and that it's just clouded, and this clouded sediment that obstructs the let's say clarity of the water. And the Buddha sort of goes even further with this one. It's not only is it sort of clouded and full of sediment and muddy, and it's also stuck off in a cupboard and closed up. It's definitely clarity is not on the screen. So that the purifying the mind of doubt and finding the ways that help the mind to step out of its tendency to doubt, to waver, to be trapped by uncertainty. Again, I mean the use of the body is very important. Bringing a real clarity, because you can bring, it's tangible. So many of the things that we doubt about and are uncertain about and are wavering about are so ephemeral. So usually on the realm of ideas and beliefs. And that's, you know, those are they're not so tangible. And in order to help the mind get back on track so that it can see clearly, see through, you know, the ideas and beliefs so that one can get a handle on it, is to come back to the body and make that, bringing energy to the body, bringing energy to the posture, bringing energy to, you know, one, the certainty of being with the sensation as it is, and it builds that momentum of let's say non-wavering, of clarity, and then is able to cut through that tendency to doubt, so that these, you know, working with and undermining, cutting through and finding skillful means to relinquish the hindrances are, you know, just ways of coming back to the original nature of the clear mind, to be able to come back to the mind of that is refreshed and refreshing, in the same way that clear, sort of cool water is refreshing. So that when we're doing this, and whether it's in the, you know, sitting meditation or walking meditation, you know, this is, you know, working with the hindrances, taking these hindrances and observing what's going on, because it's in the walking meditation, in the same way that one is attentive to the breath, well, to attend very closely to the sensation of movement, the sensation of lifting the foot, moving the foot, setting the foot down. lifting your left foot, moving it, setting it down, coming back to the simple sensation, simple rhythm of the walking meditation, and to be attentive to posture in the same way. Because sometimes we get walking and we're either tense or tight, or we're just kind of sloppily swinging arms and shuffling from one end of the walking meditation path to the other. There's sort of those two extremes, too loose and too tight. So I'm bringing you back to a point of balance where there's this attentiveness to the body, but there's a very nice composed quality where there's that keeping the hands clasped in front of one, so that there's again this nice sense of composure, walking with one's head down, just gazing in front of one, about 6 feet or so. That's a nice sort of so that one's not sort of looking up too much or looking down so much that it's a strain on the neck. It's getting this nice posture for walking, and then really relaxing the shoulders, relaxing, bringing the back up nice and straight and even. And when one's walking as well, just walking, sometimes you see people, you really see the what's going on in their mind sometimes. They're walking with their head really goes forward, and you can see that their thoughts are just pulling them along. it's not, and they're not present with the moment. So that to let the awareness suffuse the body, and walking slowly, a bit slower than normal. It's useful to walk slowly. The tendency, of course, is the mind is conditioned by the body, so that just walking a bit slower, so it's conditioning the mind in a way that, okay, slow down, take it easy, no rush, so giving the mind that opportunity to settle. To become more still, as the in walking meditation, it's helpful to it's natural for thoughts, more thoughts to come up in walking meditation, because it's just one's doing physical movement, so it conditions the mind to move as well, so that to recognize those tendencies for thoughts to arise, and then come back to the walking, come back to the sensation. If there's there can be oftentimes there can tend to be some very insightful reflections coming up on in walking meditation, and so that then, but it's again, it's really helpful to have that base of peacefulness, a base of composure and stability of mind, in order for those reflections to really go a bit deeper. So to not get too caught up in the sort of the analysis and investigation part as one's walking, because it's quite a natural movement of the mind anyway. So that not to just sort of squelch the mind, because as I said, it's natural for the mind to be turning a bit more, to be reflecting a bit more in the walking. But to try to really say protect the underlying settledness of the mind, so that those reflections are able to penetrate a bit more. And that Ajahn Chah would always say, you know, this, you know, walking meditation, you can get a lot of wisdom from walking meditation. And that and I think that you know, because it is, there's this natural tendency to, for the mind to move, so that there's, you know, there is these, you know, the reflections come up oftentimes more readily or naturally in walking meditation. But again, it is important to try to keep the base of composure and stability, so that there's a sense of mother. There's more when there's more stillness, and there's more penetration. And so even when there's the mind is moving, then it's moving from a place of stillness. It's moving from a place of clarity. So to looking after that, and then those reflections are, you know, they're really, you know, the Dhamma becomes really interesting to reflect on when there is more stillness, because it's not just skipping from one thought to another. It's really reflecting on the, you know, how does this work? How does this apply? What is the end of suffering? Where, you know, how does it come about? To offer that for reflection this morning.
Dhammayam uvatagatha tatukkara.